Begin Podfix Network transmission in 3, 2, 1.
What is up, plant people? Hey, you know what? Today is Tuesday, the 16th of March, 2021, and you're listening to the Plantherpology Podcast, the show where we dive into the lives, careers, and general awesome coolness of some wonderful plant people. I'm Vikram Baligi, your host, and I'm thrilled as always to be with you today. Hey, this one, y'all, I don't know that I've ever had a guest be this excited to be on the show. And I cannot properly express how good that makes me feel. You know, we as podcast people, human organisms, meat bags, whatever, do a lot, and it's just so cool to hear folks that want to be a part of it and that listen to it, and it's awesome. So my guest today is my friend Stephen Yonok, who is an extension program specialist with Texas A&M AgriLife Extension, working in olives. Olives are something that are near and dear to my heart. Something I studied for my master's and that I've kind of worked in on and off a little bit since then, but mostly just for my master's. And so he's actually just started his PhD working in olives as well, which is super cool and super exciting. So Stephen is someone who's been listening to the show from the beginning. And that's really, I mean, that kind of blows my mind a little bit that people have been listening from the beginning. But when I reached out to see if he wanted to be on the show, I'm pretty sure he said something to the effect of, I thought you'd never ask, which is just, I mean, again, this makes me feel so good. So we talk about a little bit of everything from how to grow olives, what all the olive industry in Texas looks like, to different grades of olive oil, and what it's like to work on a PhD and have a family, and everything and anything in between. Stephen is articulate and super intelligent and just such a great, great dude. So I think you're going to really, really enjoy this one. So grab some healthy olive oil, spread it on a piece of, what do we put olive oil on? Toast? Do we dip toast? Not toast. Grab a plate of olive oil, grab your favorite bread and dip it on in there, maybe with a nice balsamic and some, you know, crushed garlic, maybe roasted garlic. That came off the rails a little bit, but I'm leaving it in there. Anyway, get yourself ready for another great episode of Plantherpology with the Stephen Yonok. All right, well, we're back again with the Plantherpology Podcast, and I'm talking today with Stephen Yonok, who has been described by a good friend of mine as one of the most knowledgeable young folks in the AgriLife Extension Agency. And I didn't tell him I was going to throw this at him before we got started. But Stephen, how are you today?
Wow, well, I'm a lot better now. Jeez, thanks for the compliment. I didn't expect that. That's terrific. I'm doing great today. Thanks. How are you?
Man, I'm good. We're recording this on a Friday, and it's Friday afternoon, so we're even closer to the weekend, so I'm doing pretty well.
Absolutely.
So, Stephen, we'll kind of just jump right into it. So you are an extension program specialist. Is that correct with Texas A&M AgriLife?
That's correct. Yes, you got it right.
Awesome. And it's funny because, like, I was with Extension for quite a while. And so, like, I know, not I say that, it wasn't that, 4 or 5 years. And so I see some of these titles. And I'll be honest with you, I stalked you a little bit today because I was like, okay, I know he's changed positions at one point, but I don't know what his title is now. So I had to make sure that I got that right. We'll talk a little bit more about what that means, being an extension program specialist, and what you study, which is something that is kind of near and dear to my heart in a lot of ways. But tell me what got you into plants and agriculture? How'd you get to where you are today?
You know, I guess it was destiny, really. to be honest, when I was growing up, I did not have an interest in plants. I never thought that I would be where I am today. And so to give that some context, my dad was a county extension agent here in Texas for 34 years. And excuse me, I actually get a little choked up sometimes thinking about it, because he was the first in the family to go to college, and then he was a, you know, extension agent for 34 years and was really respected in the community. I mean, he was known as this immense source of knowledge, and you know, we couldn't go anywhere in town without people saying, "Hey, Joe, you know, how are you? You know, you came to my farm and helped out." And so that's what I grew up with a guy that was the plant expert. You know, he was the plant nerd of his time and in his place. And so we grew up in Victoria, Texas. Our family had a little 22-acre place outside of town. And, you know, we didn't farm necessarily, I guess, sort of, but we had a big garden every year. And when I say big, like, we had maybe 200 tomato plants, you know, 50 different types of peppers. I mean, we grew everything, sweet corn, squash, beans, okra, all the typical vegetables. And then we had fruit trees. We had pecan trees, blackberries, grapes, peaches, pears, figs, plums, and maybe some other things. But I had two older brothers as well. They're 5 and 6 years older than me. And so there's three boys in the family. And, you know, my dad was just in heaven because he had three boys to go outside and help him all day long in the big garden. And the one thing he made us do was help him tend the garden first, so we learned. And second, it was a 4-H project. I was in 4-H for 10 years. And we grew the vegetables, and we took them to the Victoria Farmers Market, and we sold vegetables all summer long, Wednesdays and Saturdays at the Victoria Farmers Market. And
wow.
I hated it. I mean, honestly, when I was maybe 6 to 10 years old, I hated tomatoes. And today I love tomatoes, you know.
Sure.
But I didn't like it. You know, I wanted to be indoors. I wanted to be playing video games or doing something fun, hanging out with my friends. But we did very little of that when I was a kid. We were outside working in the garden. And I actually made enough money through 4-H and through the farmer's market selling vegetables to buy my own truck, my first truck. Wow. It was a used vehicle, but I bought it in cash myself. With money I made from growing and selling vegetables and some 4-H animal projects as well.
Sure.
So that's kind of the background. Also, I remember going out with Dad, you know, when he was extension agent, maybe I'd be off of school in the summer, and he would take me on farm visits or on home visits when he visited, you know, homeowners. And I can remember him, you know, getting called out to look at somebody's yard. And he looked around for a couple of minutes, and then he knelt down, and he never said anything. He was just looking and observing, and he knelt down, and he grabbed the St. Augustine grass, and he just pulled it and started rolling it like a roll of carpet. And he said, "Look, you've got grub worms." And I just thought, man, how did he know? You know, he didn't say anything. He didn't ask a lot. He just knew. He just knew what to do. Yeah. And I remember going with him. We would go to, you know, he had variety trials, corn and cotton and sorghum. And I remember picking cotton by hand, dragging a sack through the field. I'm one of the only ones of our generation that can say they've done that. So that's kind of how I grew up around it. But I didn't really develop this love for plants and for the outdoors. I guess until later in high school, maybe even into college. I don't know what happened necessarily. I just started getting interested in plants and the outdoors for a while there. In the first part of college, I thought maybe I would be a forest ranger or a park ranger.
Right.
You know, that sounded like a dream job. You're in a national park. You're on vacation, but it's your job. It sounded like a fun deal. So that's kind of how it started. I started at Victoria College for 2 years and then transferred to Texas A&M at College Station there. And okay. I still didn't know what I wanted to do. In fact, when I left Victoria College, my major was agribusiness. And I wasn't real excited about the economics classes and some of the calculus and stuff that we had to do. So when I got to A&M, I had another fortuitous event. I had a good advisor, undergraduate advisor, and since I didn't know what to do, she said, "Well, why don't you why don't you look at this major? It was renewable natural resources.
Okay.
She said it's a broad major, covers a lot of different things, and it turned out to be probably as good of an experience as I could ask for out of college, because I had classes on hydrology and watersheds. I had plants of North America. I had dendrology, which is the study of trees.
Yeah.
You know, some wildlife courses, some ecosystem restoration type courses. And so it was a wonderful, you know, a little piece of this, a little piece of this. It wasn't too narrow and focused, and I just loved it. And so that was college. For a while, when I was a junior and senior at A&M, I worked as a student worker for Dr. Baron Rector. And if anybody knows Dr. Baron Rector, they'll know why I'm kind of laughing right now, because he is a character. I mean, he's kind of known for being flashy and loud, but more so known for this, I don't know, this just extreme knowledge of plants. I mean, the man could walk out anywhere, literally anywhere in the state of Texas, look down at the ground at any plant, and he could give you the scientific name. He could tell you if it's native or non-native, cool season or warm season, you know, if it's good for cattle, if goats would eat it, what wildlife would eat it. I mean, he was a literal encyclopedia of natural resource knowledge. Yeah. And I just couldn't get enough. I mean, it just floored me to work for him and to learn from him. For a while there at A&M, I was also on the plant identification team.
Wow.
And you know, working with Dr. Rector helped with that. In fact, we were the number one team in the nation in 2012. Although we lost to Canada, a university from Canada.
Well,
but we were the number one university team in the nation. And a university from Mexico was right behind us. So that was cool. That was kind of college. I graduated and really still didn't have a thing that I wanted to do. Didn't really know. In the meantime, I had met a girl, and this is where things took a turn.
Classic story. Yeah. Yeah.
So I moved to Colorado. Pagosa Springs, Colorado, for a year and a half to date my girlfriend, who we're now married for 5 years, 6 years now, something. It's been marital bliss.
Well, that's good to hear. I'm glad to hear that.
So I lived up there for a year and a half. I worked on a big 4,000-acre ranch. I ran irrigation and did the fencing and took care of the pastures and stuff, and that was great. I really learned a lot. I mean, it was a beautiful place. I mean, right nestled in the mountains in this beautiful, lush valley at the base of Wolf Creek Pass, the headwaters of the San Juan River.
Yeah, I know exactly where that is, for sure.
Oh, yeah. So if you've driven Wolf Creek Pass and there's a little scenic overlook where you can pull off and you look over that whole valley, that valley is where I worked. That whole valley
is cool.
The ranch that I worked on. I mean,
that's super cool. Yeah, growing up, we had a cabin in South Fork.
Oh.
And so I've been over Wolf Creek Pass a lot of times, headed to, you know, Creed and Pagosa Springs and a lot of those places.
Right.
I think I've got a bunch of pictures from that scenic overlook you're talking about. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, so you can understand then the majestic beauty of the place, and it really was fantastic. I was there for a year and a half, and I kept... The boss realized I knew some things, right? I had a college education. I could identify plants. I knew about weed control. And so he kept giving me more things to do, clear up the weeds in the pond, you know, fix what's wrong with these trees around the house. And so I kept doing all those things, but he wouldn't pay me anything extra. So again, another fortuitous event. I had one of the guys that owned the cattle on the place. He was actually a retired extension agent from Texas. It's weird how we linked up in Colorado.
Yeah.
But he realized the situation I was in, and he said, you know, you can do better. You're smart. You need to – I think you would make a good county extension agent. And sure enough, I took his advice. I applied and was interviewed and got the job. And, in fact, I moved to Colorado County, Texas.
Okay, so that's funny, because that's That's where I thought you had been. And when you said you like had moved to like Colorado, I was like, wait, was I wrong? Like, was I that far off? But that's pretty interesting.
Yeah. So anyways, that's how I got into extension, and I spent 4 years at Colorado County, and that's a wonderful job, as you know, working for extension.
Yeah.
If you want to talk about training on the job, I mean, I don't know if there's a better way to do it, because it's trial by fire, but it's a wonderful way to get training on the job. I can remember my first day on the job, and I'm kind of embarrassed to think about it now. My first day on the job, this lady came in. She had a little piece of a tree branch in her hand, and it was a citrus tree. I don't remember if it was an orange or something. And the leaves were covered with this black film. Mm-hmm. And, of course, today I know that's an easy diagnosis. It's some kind of a sucking insect pest that's right. excreting honeydew, and the black sooty mold grows on the honeydew. Well, I had no idea. This first day on the job, had no idea. So I'm all excited to take pictures and send it off to a specialist and get answers. And, you know, did that, basically that for 4 years. And that's how, you know, I just learned an incredible amount working yeah. as an agent. And, you know, we had to wrap up the story to get to where I am now. We had pecan educational programs, because pecans are kind of a large, big part of agriculture here in this area, at least along the rivers. And one of the horticulture specialists from campus had come down for a program. And of course he saw how I ran the program, and we got to talk. And long story short, when my current position came open, they actually did a set of interviews first and didn't find anybody they wanted. So then he called me and asked if I would apply That's cool. for the position. So yeah, I've been extremely blessed. Like I said, there's been some fortuitous events happen to me that's led me to where I am, but it's really been a beautiful ride.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And so you've done a little bit of everything, sort of, you know, from ranching to farming to dealing with people at a farmer's market, which is quite a skill in and of itself. To everything in between. That's really cool. So here's a question I want to throw at you, because I spent 4 years as a county agent, mm-hmm. and people ask you the weirdest stuff, So what is if you can think of one, I'm sure there, you've got a list somewhere in your brain. What's the strangest question you ever got?
Yeah, this is one of those. I'm going to need a second to think, or may have to come back to it or something.
Oh, that's fine. We can do that too.
You know, I think every extension agent gets at least one of these in their career. And I was fortunate enough to have one in one of the first two or three years. And I forget what it's called, but it's when people come in and they swear that there's some type of insect or bug yeah. mm-hmm. on their skin, and it's, mm-hmm. it's really nothing there. And that's not like a weird or something to laugh about necessarily. I felt bad for the lady, but I you just didn't know how to handle it. Like, ma'am, she handed me this strip of tape.
Yeah.
And she said, I got some of those bugs on the tape here. Would you take a look, tell me what they are and how to control them? And, you know, I'm looking at the tape. I get my little magnifier and I'm looking and there's nothing there. It's fuzz and dust bunnies. Mm-hmm. So that was probably one of the weirder ones.
You know, and it's interesting you say that, because we would get those too, like the exact same thing. People would come in with tape and be like, you know, these insects are kind of what you just described. And you know, we would be careful to say, you know, we're not medical professionals. Right. You know, if you feel like there's a medical issue, go see your doctor. But one of the big things about extension, and I'm glad you kind of brought that up, is that people still look, you know, maybe extension is not as known from household to household as it was 60 years ago, you know, right. in the past. But there's enough people that still look at the extension agency, the extension service, as a valuable resource in their lives. Whether it's like, my tree's sick, I'd been there about a month, and I got a letter in the mail with a sheet of paper. It had a little twig tape to it and a bunch of like powder in the bottom of the envelope. And all it said was, "What's wrong with my tree?" And so this person had like cut a twig off and taped it to it, and so all, you know, by the time it got to me, the leaves are dust, and I wanted to write back and be like, "You keep pulling the leaves off of it. That's what's wrong with it." So we get that on one, like on one hand, and when there's some funny stuff like that, like someone called and asked me, "Where can I buy bats?" Like. Huh. Like the animal bats, you know, control mosquitoes. And I was like, you can't. But then we do get like folks that legitimately are like, I need help. I have this question, and here is a source of information. And I think that like a good county agent, which I know you were, is looked at as a valuable resource in the community.
I think I agree with you 1,000%, and that made me think of a good story to illustrate your point. I had a lady call that said, "We have sinkholes. There's sinkholes opening up in my pasture. They're in my yard. I'm afraid that the one's going to open up under my house, and my house is going to fall in." And the way I understood, these were small-ish. You know, they weren't the ones you see on TV. They're maybe 5 feet wide and a few feet deep. But she said, "I have sinkholes. Do you know why?" And of course, I had not a clue at first.
Right.
So as a good county extension agent with the backing of Texas A&M University, what do? I turn to the university, turn to the professionals. And so, you know, there was really nobody in extension necessarily that I thought could help. So I got on and looked up a name of a professor in the Department of Geology. Geology, right? The rocks,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right. Yes, yeah.
Anyways, emailed him, told him where we were, what the problem was, and he emailed back within a day or so and said, you know, it's just due to your soil type. You've got this sandy layer of clay lying on top of this You got this sandy layer of soil lying over the top of this this heavy clay layer, and that clay layer is a shrink swell clay. So when it gets dry, it shrinks and cracks open up. When it gets wet, it swells and the cracks close. Well, what was happening, I believe this was right around maybe 2013 or 2015, we had some drought and those cracks were opening up in the subsoil. Then we would have rain and that would wash in the sand. Then it would open, you know, it even erode those cracks even more. And that's what was causing the sinkholes. And so I was able to give her an answer like, look, this isn't, you shouldn't expect any kind of catastrophic sinkhole that's going to swallow your house. It's probably not going to happen around your house because you're shedding the rain away from the house. You've got grass holding things together. And so I could ease her worries by doing that. So that was like you said, they didn't know where to turn. They probably nobody else in the county would have been able to answer that. Maybe a geologist or somebody, but so yeah, they turned to me and I had no clue. So I turned to the university.
Well, and so, and we've talked about this on the show. It's been a while since I've really had a lot of extension folks on. So I'm enjoying talking to you about this because what I've always thought was the most like meaningful part of what, at least at my time there, was that we were able to take knowledge to people where they were, right? It was like, it was kind of leaving the ivory tower, if you want to call it that. Like, instead of just saying, here's all of this information that Texas A&M or another university generates, it's like, no, we're closing the feedback loop,
right?
We're taking the knowledge they've paid for through taxes or whatever else, and we're giving it back to them. And I think that's like for the average person, or just a homeowner, anyone who needs a service, it's very empowering, right, to have that information they need.
Yeah. No, I agree. And I think that's the best part of extension. I had a guy one time that, you know, he was a construction home builder, but he had, I don't know, 50 acres of land, and he made a little hay and he ran a few cows. And he called me that he wasn't really getting any grass production. He says, "I'm fertilizing. I'm doing everything I'm supposed to do according to your, you know, your books and your fact sheets and stuff, but I'm just not getting any grass growth." And so I went out and visited him. And to me, that's the best part of extension is making home visits, like you said, and bringing it to the people. Well, turns out, yes, he was following instructions to apply fertilizer, but he was using liquid fertilizer and he didn't understand the ratios and the mixing. So he was actually applying like half a pound of nitrogen per acre when he really needed like 80 pounds.
Right.
So he was following our instructions, but he just you know, he didn't quite understand. And so it was great. I was able to visit with him personally. We did the math on the back of his tractor, you know, and we talked about how it would work, and he had better success the next year.
That's awesome. And so I guess that kind of brings me to my next question. So now you're, you know, you've moved from this role as a county agent, a county level educator, to a program specialist, with extension. How has that changed your job? How has that changed the way that your, I mean, even just like your average day goes?
You know, I miss it a little bit. I miss being an agent a little bit, because when you're the county agent, you are the expert source for your people in the county. And, you know, as a program specialist, yeah, I'm still regarded, I guess, somewhat as a expert, even if I may not consider myself one yet. But there's just a lot less in-person day-to-day interaction. You know, I have an office here, but in the 2.5 years I've been here, probably 15 people have walked through the door.
Right.
Where as an agent, it's nearly every day somebody coming through the door. So that's the big change, that I feel between the two jobs.
Okay. So what's your specific area of focus? I mean, kind of mentioned it as we started out, but what do you work with? What's your main thing?
Well, olives, I guess, yeah. Is my main thing. What I'm working on is what we're calling the Sustainable Fruit Project.
Okay.
And I've got my elevator speech here, I think. We seek to determine the potential profitability and sustainability of perennial fruit and nut crops in the greater mid-coastal region of Texas.
You did good. Yeah, good job.
So that just means, for example, I have trials with blackberries, pears, figs, and of course olives. But you know, olives are a new thing, but the blackberry, figs, and pears, that's nothing new. We've studied them before. We know, we've done previous economic analysis on them before, but now we have new varieties. We have improved agronomic practices. You know, we have better understanding of fertilizers and water quality and soils. And so what we're trying to do is evaluate those new varieties, new cultivars, in conjunction with our improved practices, and then apply that to today's market. You know, what's the market today? Especially with the rise of, at least down here, I've seen what I think is a big increase in the pick your own,
yeah,
type orchards and farms. And so just to that's what I'm trying to do, evaluate those different crops, the new stuff, and see how that fits in with today's market. You know, prices are different today. Fertilizer price gone up like $100 a ton in the last couple of weeks.
I'm sure. Yeah.
So that's kind of what we're trying to do with this project. And then the main focus is olives as sort of a new crop in Texas.
Okay. So this is where I've been, you know, trying to steer us towards olives. So we were going to get to olives. So I did my master's degree in olive production, which feels like 100 years ago at this point. I think I've probably finished my master's about the same time you, when did you graduate from A&M?
13.
Okay. Yeah. So I finished my master's in 2012. Mm. And at the time, there was not a lot of research going into olives. I think our project actually here from Texas Tech was one of the first like big major like university research projects in the state of Texas on olives. And it was funny because like when I was, you know, I did my undergrad at A&M too. I was class of 09 and did a victory lap, whatever, you know, it is what it is. And so like I was applying to grad school and it was coming to Tech, and the professor I worked with, Cynthia McKinney and Thane Montag, they were like, "What are you interested in?" And I told them, and they were like, "Well, there's funding for olives." And I was like, "I'm interested in olives." And so ended up doing a drought study in or variable irrigation study in olives. We'd looked at oil and a few other things. But it was funny because I started, like, as I would tell people about what I was doing, they were like, "They don't grow olives in Texas." Mm. Do you still get that?
All the time.
Yeah.
And that's part of what we're trying to do as well, is to bring light to the olive industry in the state.
So it's been a while since I've really been, you know, in the know, so to speak. So can you give us sort of the cliff notes of the state of the Texas olive industry?
Sure, absolutely. It's difficult to nail down. for example, you can't just, I mean, you can go on USDA websites and pull up the number reported acreage of olive orchards in Texas. Mm-hmm. And I believe it's somewhere around 1200 acres in the state. Through some of my own reconnaissance and working with other growers and orchard installers, we're estimating about 4,000 acres in the state, which I think makes it the number two or the number three fruit crop. Huh. Aside from grapes and pecans, you know, pecans and grapes are number one or two, I think. I think the next one is peaches, and then I think olives is right below peaches.
Wow.
So yeah, it's nothing to just push aside. It's here. It's 4,000 acres. We're estimating, look at my cliff notes here, close to 2 million trees, olive trees in the state. So, and the majority of these are smaller to moderate size orchards, usually, let's say 10 to 20 acres. There are some that are over 100 acres. We have some that are like 110, 120 acres. But the majority, you know, the median of them, as we were talking about, is somewhere around that 10 to 20. In fact, I've done a survey that shows that. 99% of the olives grown in Texas are grown for the production of extra virgin olive oil. I don't know if I know anybody actually that's commercially producing what we call table olives. Those are the ones brined, you know, and you buy in a jar and you eat. I don't know anybody commercially producing those. I know some growers, you know, pull some for themselves and brine it on the side. So yeah, mostly here for oil production. And, you know, when I started this, I didn't really have an interest in olives either. my previous knowledge of olives was that they're maybe not well suited and probably may not be the next big thing. That was what I thought before. And you know, I always just bought, I didn't care about olive oil. I just bought the store brand stuff. It was just oil to me, something you cook with. Now that I've experienced and tasted like true, fresh, extra virgin olive oil from the literally straight from the olive mill, I mean, I can't go back. I can never buy a store brand olive oil ever again, because they're a lot of them are not great, but the true fresh stuff is it's a fantastic. It's not a. It shouldn't be looked at as a, you know, something you just cook with. It should be looked at as a flavoring. It's enjoyable. It should be enjoyable to sip olive oil on its own. I mean, it's different, but it should be enjoyable, fresh, green, grassy, kind of fruity flavor with a little bit of a twinge in the back of the throat, kind of a spiciness. That's good olive oil, and Texas growers are making it.
Yeah. Well, and you know, it's funny you say that, because I think after my first year, we went down to Carrizo Springs, to one of the big orchards down there, and just so we don't get anyone in, you know, trouble for saying specific names, but one of the big orchard down in Carrizo Springs, down for one of their olive harvest festivals, just as a, you know, we were taking data and stuff like that, but we just happened to go that weekend and we gave a presentation and stuff. And so, yeah, they let us taste, you know, oil right off of the press or out of the mill. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked at how different all the varietals are.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but like between wines or different things, you get so much complex flavor profile from one variety to another. And it was spicier than I expected, because I'm used to the store brand stuff that doesn't really taste like anything. And it's really kind of like, if you're out there listening, if you ever get the chance to go taste a fresh olive oil somewhere, or even like to a store that sells different varietals and you can taste the differences, it's really pretty amazing.
It really is. I've been blown away. I'm kind of an olive nut now, I guess. Or maybe I should be an olive droop.
I like that.
Horticulture.
Us plant people are so nerdy, and I'm okay with it. I like that joke. Well, let's take a quick break, and we come back, we'll talk about olive oil. Well, hello there, friends. Welcome to the mid-roll, your favorite part of the show. I hope this is not your favorite part of the show where I ramble at you more. I shouldn't be your favorite part of the show. Don't even listen to me. Just listen to the guests. They're way better than me. Hey, I don't have a lot to plug to you today. I just wanted to drop in and say hello. How you doing? How you holding up? You spending that stimmy on anything fun? No? Is it annoying that people are calling it a stimmy yet? Probably. Anyway, if you're listening to this at some point in the future, you probably have no idea what I'm talking about. And I don't care. That's fine. So, hey, I hope you're following along with all things Planthropology out there on the interweb machine. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Search for Planthropology and look for the bristlecone pine drawn by the wonderful Dr. Beth Nichols. She's wonderful. Go listen to her episode, too. She's even more wonderful as a guest. And you can go follow us along and be part of the fun at the Planthropology's Cool Plant People Facebook group. It's a good time. Lots of memes, lots of questions, lots of answers, great pictures. I think you'll enjoy it. You should go be a part of it. I'm also on the TikToks for some reason. I'm the 33-year-old old guy who you will never see dancing, I promise. But I post some cool, fun, interesting sometimes, I hope. Plant content. I don't know. I think you'll like it. Go join it. If you want to support the show, you can do so at patreon.com/planthropology. Hey, also, I would appreciate it if you wouldn't mind dropping a rating and review for the show. If you're a regular listener or a new listener and you're enjoying this one, head over to Apple Podcasts, CastBox, Stitcher, Podchaser, really anywhere else you can leave a review and a rating and do the thing. It really helps out, and I would really appreciate it. Not that much more. I'm going to play you a trailer for one of my other podcasts that I make sometimes when I remember, the Plant Prof Podcast, where this one is all about the cool things that my guests do. That one is about whatever cool plant thing happens to be on my brain that day. So I think you'll like it. So yes, follow on social media, leave a rating and review, keep listening, mash that subscribe button. Yo, I'm so old and lame. And get ready for a trailer from the Plant Prof Podcast in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Well, hello there, and welcome to The Plant Prof. My name is Dr. Vikram Baliga. I am a PhD in horticulture, an instructor in the same thing, a university greenhouse manager, and your friendly neighborhood podcast host who likes to talk about random plant facts and answer your questions. Join us for this silly, fun, laid-back show as we talk about all things in the plant kingdom and a few things that aren't. It'll come out every week. You'll get to hear it with your ear parts, and it'll be fun for everyone. Be sure to subscribe and tune in, and I will see you real soon. So can you tell us the difference between some of the olive oil grades? Because talking to folks, that's, I think, not well understood.
Yeah, you're right. And I'm not, I'll just what's the word? Disclaimer here for myself. I'm more on the agronomic side of things, you know, how to grow the tree. Right. I'm trying to understand that. But we did go to California 1 year for the master milling course, where you learn how to take the fruit and mill it into oil and all the things that go into it. So you're asking about like the difference between extra virgin olive oil,
yes,
virgin right. olive oil, and just regular olive oil. Mm-hmm. And basically it's sort of a measure of freshness, and a couple other things. So olive oil is like 90-something% triglycerides. Mm-hmm. I think that's right. I mean, you should know this too, right? Help me out.
You know, right. I know. I'm just making you say it.
Because oil is a fat, right? And fat is right, triglycerides. Right. And triglycerides have these three fatty acid chains connected to something.
Right.
As oxidation occurs, or as a fermentation or breakdown, decomposition, as the oil becomes rancid, those free fatty acids break off, right? That's called oxidation when they break off. And so extra virgin olive oil, it depends what standards you're using, but I think the international standards are less than 0.08% free fatty acids.
Okay.
So that's the main determining factor for the quality label of olive oil, is the free fatty acid content, literally just a measure of how much oxidation fermentation has taken place. Virgin olive oil is like 0.8 to 2% free fatty acids. Regular olive oil, I think, is man, now you're gonna have me guessing.
No, it's okay.
It's above 2%. What I was getting to is that there's a final low grade called Lampante oil. And I don't know if that's Spanish or Italian or Greek or what, but it literally just means lamp oil. Huh. And they just, it's such a low grade, it's not fit for human consumption. It's more better used for burning for fuel.
That's interesting. And so, like, that's largely, as I understand it, like I said, it's been a minute since I've studied this. You know, it's a function of time, right? You said the longer that the drupe sits off the tree, all those polyphenols and triglycerides and all the stuff that we tend to think of, oh, olive oil is good for you, they start breaking down. Oxygen turns out is not great for anything. Like, oxygen's not really good for you. Like, we need it's a weird catch 22 because we need it to live, but it's slowly killing us. And but the same's true of like grapes and olives and all these. So you can correct me if I'm wrong, but a lot of the higher quality olive oils come from farms that probably have a press on site, like an on-farm press. Is that correct?
It depends, but yes, in general, you're going to have a higher chance of making a high quality olive oil if you can mill it, get it from the tree to the mill as fast as possible. You can still make good quality oil without milling it on site. Sure. It depends how you handle it. You know, you got to keep them below certain temperatures so they're not degrading in a hot, you know, room or something. So you can without doing it on site, but yes, typically the best oils come from orchards and fields that have a mill on site. And so, for example, I work with an orchard pretty closely near Cotulla, down in Southwest Texas. Mm-hmm. They don't have a mill on site, but one thing cool that Texas does have is a mobile mill. And so it's a fully housed, fully integrated olive mill on a semi-trailer that they pull around, and they actually go to California and Arizona and these other states and mill for them after Texas harvest is over. But getting back to the story, they take the mobile mill to the orchard, and this is one of the larger orchards, in the neighborhood of 100 acres down there, and they can go from fruit on the tree to oil in the storage container in less than 2 hours.
Wow.
I mean, of course, everything's mechanized, right? It's a it's a machine harvester that harvests the fruit, and then another tractor with a trailer takes the fruit to the mill, and then they dump it in, and then they're milling it within minutes. They make some of the best oil that way.
That's cool. And I think I'm going to probably tag a video on when I post this episode, because some of this machinery is really interesting to look at. Like, it's the wild. First time I saw an olive harvester, the only way I could describe it was like a car wash with corkscrews in it that run, like the one that I saw run, and there's probably different types. Mm-hmm. Like, it, you know, it's like a big car wash looking thing that runs over the top of the trees. And just like these big screws turn and like strip the olives off. And I was like, it was interesting kind of walking behind it as it was harvesting, because that's, you know, we got to see the whole process. I was like, it does an incredible amount of damage to the trees, right? It like rips branches off and all this stuff. And we were asking the farmer, they were like, oh yeah, we don't care. We go back and we shear them and hedge them and they're fine. Like,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The whole experience is pretty wild. I know what you're talking about, those type of harvesters. I think those are more dual purpose, like grape and olive harvesters. The ones that I'm familiar with are similar. They drive over the tree. They're literally called over the row harvesters. So yeah, the tree is usually anywhere from 10 to 15 tall, and this 10 to 15 feet tall, this machine straddles them. and drives over the top. And it's got, the ones I've seen have bars, like plastic bars that are horizontal, and they go back and forth. And I know your listeners can't see me doing this with my fingers.
They can imagine. That's fine.
But it literally beats it back and forth. And that's what shakes the olives off. Of course, at the bottom, there's these like a conveyor belt of plates that keep the olives from hitting the ground. And then, of course, it gets transferred into these buckets on this conveyor chain, and it gets dumped into the bin. Yes. But it's pretty wild. And yeah, they've literally ripped trees out of the ground with this thing. If the row of trees is not perfectly straight, if one tree is off a little bit, that harvester machine is like 25 feet long. It can't adjust because the tree spacing is 5 feet.
Right.
So that tree that's out of place, hey, we'll replant it.
That's really interesting to talk about too, because I think, you know, when I think of an olive grove or an olive orchard, I get like this picture of an idyllic, like mountainside, you know, the big trees that are 4,000 years old somewhere in Spain or Italy. Mm. But in commercial production, we're planting, or the farmers are planting, in these super high density orchards. That's like, you know, 600-700 trees per acre. And so if you think of like any kind of like row agriculture, you're doing that except with trees, and it's really fascinating to look at.
Right. Absolutely. And that's maybe something we should have clarified before. There are kind of like two schools of thought on how to grow olives. And you're right. The traditional way, the old school way, is the, like you're talking about, the idyllic picture of Italy, right? They're spaced out wide. The trees are low, and they're very wide, and they're very big. That's the old style way. About 25 years ago, it's really a kind of a recent technological advance, really, is what it is. They started this, what they're calling super high density olive production, where they're very closely spaced, like 5 feet apart. The trees are 5 feet apart, and they literally form a hedgerow. So if you think of like a hedgerow of boxwoods or some kind of holly or something, it literally looks like that. Like you said, they shear the sides of them with these big blades mounted on the front of tractors, and they just shear them off. Not every year typically, but that's how they keep them to size. And so that's the two different approaches, I guess, to farming olives.
And it depends on, you know, how you're mechanizing, what your, you know, production goals are. It's really kind of interesting to think about. You know, my family has a little peach orchard, and we have sort of a wider spacing. We have like probably 20 feet between the rows, and then 15 feet within the row. So we have a pretty wide spacing on our trees when, you know, a lot of modern, those trees have been in the ground a while, but a lot of current peach orchards are probably half that, right? Like maybe not between the rows, but within the row, you know, 8 to 10 foot spacing is pretty common, and or less in some cases.
Higher production per acre is what they're after, right?
Yeah. And it makes each tree less valuable individually, which is good and bad, right? Like if you're just harvesting from one tree, that's not good. But then if you rip one out of the ground, it's less of a big deal, right? You're not sacrificing as much. So it's, I don't know. I think fruit production is really interesting to study. And I think there's so much more that goes into it than I think anyone really probably anticipates or thinks about, which is why I think our conversation is so important, because people go and they're like, why is this so expensive? You know, and I think people need to understand everything that goes into into the production of what they're consuming. Right. I think this, you know, which is what makes your job so important, because people need to know. It is so important for people to know that
over the row harvester is somewhere in the neighborhood of $250,000. So you know, if you want top quality olive oil, there's a fair price that comes with it, and that's why. Yeah, you're exactly right.
Yeah. Well, and olive oil, other things, wines, apples, whatever you've got, like there is a farmer somewhere, whether it's a small family farm or a big, you know, commercial farm, that is putting a lot of blood, sweat, and tears and equipment cost into producing that piece of food that you're consuming.
Yeah. And if it's not a, mechanized, you know, $250,000 harvester that they're using, they're paying probably near the same amount to hire workers to harvest that fruit. Some of those things that have to be harvested by hand. So yeah, it's literally, like you said, blood, sweat, and tears. I've seen it all.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. So switching gears just a little bit, I just looked down and we're already 45 minutes in, so I don't want to take your whole day, but I'm enjoying this conversation. I think it's fascinating.
Yeah, I'm having a blast.
So you've just gone back to school.
Yeah.
I understand that response really well. So what are you studying?
No, I have, and I'm actually really excited. It's just a little overwhelming sometimes being out of school 7 years and now going back for grad school. So I am pursuing a PhD in horticulture.
Awesome. Awesome. From Texas A&M?
Right, at Texas A&M, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Man, I feel that so much because I was out about 4 years before I went back and for my PhD. And, you know, I was working with Extension too. I was a county agent when I started. And gosh, so I know you're just getting going on this, but I know we have a lot of folks that listen that, you know, think about going back to school or maybe you're in a similar position. What are your thoughts so far? I know you're just getting into it, but what are your thoughts so far on kind of going back as a non-traditional student?
Nothing has changed, really. I mean, you know, I have two classes in a lab now. Sorry.
You're fine.
You know, I have two classes in a lab now, and they're both online, and like the first couple of days, I was just really intimidated by the online system because it's not one that I had used before. But yeah, a few days with it, and it's not all that different from what I experienced, you know, 7, 8, 10 years ago. I don't know how else to answer that. What was the question? You may have to cut that out.
That's fine. We can. The question was really just like, how is your, I was really just asking like, how has your experience been so far? Kind of going back to school after a while being out, working full time, all that.
Well, and right now where I am, you know, we're still in the first couple of weeks of the semester, and that's always the easy part, right? It's the review of the syllabus, the review of what you should already know. And so it's not been bad at all. You know, really one of the more challenging and worrying things for me up to this point has just been making sure I'm meeting all these requirements in the graduate handbook, you know, minimum class number and just figuring it all out. And there's a little bit less guidance that's thrown at you. You have to go out and find it. It's there. There's people that are happy to help you. There's tons of advisors and professors will give you advice all day, but you got to go out and reach for it. You got to ask for it. And that's a little bit challenging sometimes for somebody like me. I'm a little introverted. You know, sometimes you just got to do what you got to do and to get some help and you know, you figure it out. It's funny, you get challenged and you get down and you get discouraged and then you take a step back and you accomplish one small thing and you mark it off the list and you go, all right, you know, that's a good feeling. I've done something. I can do this now. So let me take on the next thing and then the next thing and the next thing. So it's been great so far. It's just, you know, learning and getting back in the swing of things and learning to ask for help when you really need it.
Sure. Well, and you know, I would encourage you having recently gone through kind of the same thing myself and trying to figure out how to, you know, we talk about work-life balance and school-life balance and when you've got to do both at the same time, that's it can be a challenge, right? It can be a daunting task. And you know, I think the best advice I would have for someone in a position like you are going back to do school, working full time, having family obligations, all of that is just, you know, I think perspective is important. I think, and this is for anyone else listening too, that when I started, gosh, I was like, how am I going to do this? How am I going to like get through all of it? And this is not a helpful answer, but you kind of just do in some way. It's like, so when my son was born, I thought all the time, how am I going to function in life without sleep? How am I going to, know how to do some of the things that I have to do as a parent? And you can read every book, you can read every like how-to guide on how to be a parent, how to be a non-traditional student, whatever. And none of that survives like first, like what do they say? No plan survives first contact with the enemy. That's kind of the same thing. Like it kind of just, you just do it. You just do it. And, there are things that I think I wish I would have done just in terms of like budgeting my time, keeping a calendar better and like not letting some things bleed into other things. So like it feels weird to schedule personal time and time with your family. But at some point it was like, I'm going to put 3 hours on my calendar of time I spend with my family. And that's all I'm going to do. I'm not going to think about school. I am in a meeting with my wife and my son for the next 3 hours. But you almost just have to do it because like no one, and I think this is good advice for any student, any worker, no one is going to protect your time. Yeah. So you have to do it. Yeah. Right. And at the end of the day, it's like, we do these things for our families and we do these things for our own like self-betterment. So those are things worth protecting through the process.
Those family meetings are the most important meetings to make.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause you can always reschedule, a meeting with an advisor or with a clientele if you're in extension or whatever. But at some point, like you don't want to have to keep rescheduling time with your wife or whatever. And it's important. It's an important thing that we overlook.
1,000%. That's excellent advice. And, I realize I'm fortunate in my position. We don't have any kids yet, at least. And so I have a little more flexibility on time in that sense. But, to be honest and to be maybe a little fangirl here, when I started listening to your podcast a year and a half ago, I wasn't thinking about grad school, but I heard you talking about it because you were finishing your PhD and finishing that process, right? And so I heard you talk about things like managing your time and budgeting and calendars and making lists. And I've really honestly started to learn to do that a lot better here recently. And then you talked about things like, what's it called? Imposter syndrome.
Oh, man. Yeah.
I had no idea that was a term before I heard you guys talking about it. And I realized all of a sudden, oh, my gosh, that's me. I'm 30 years old and I'm supposed to be this expert and supposed to be going for a PhD. And why me? I feel like I don't know enough. I don't know anything yet. I just bring all that up to say, I think also important to have some kind of support network, especially in the situation we are now when we're so, removed, we can't visit each other and we're distancing and everything. It's good to have some kind of support network, or at least somebody that can relate to what you're going through. And so you introduced me to Twitter and the, academic Twitter and grad school and stuff on there. And that's been, that's been really impactful in my experience.
Well, man, I'm glad to hear that you have taken some value from all of my rambling. but it's an important lesson. And I think that academia can be isolating a lot of times, and especially right now, right when you can't work with a lab group, it's even more isolating being non-traditional. So during my master's, like some of my best friends today who've mostly been on the show, Kyle Tengler and Daniel Cunningham and Becky Bowling and Kaylee and Amber, who have all been on the show at this point, they're still some of my best friends. And we work together constantly and all of that. And so like going into my PhD as a full-time worker dude, or whatever, it was weird not having that group who I could constantly rely on. And so it's important, but like you just said, to find a support system, whoever that is, whether it's, it's nice to have like the family support system, but you kind of have to have at least one person you can talk to that when you say, oh my God, I've got 30 hours of homework and I've got to get all these reports in. It's kind of, it's helpful to have someone that can be like, yeah, I've been there and it blows, but you'll get through it. You know,
can we say that kind of stuff on here?
So far I have not gotten fired for saying stuff. So
it's your
all
show,
right.
Huh?
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right though. Yep.
So we'll kind of start wrapping up. I hope we've covered, you know, mostly everything you wanted to talk about. Do I leave anything out?
I mean, we could talk, I think, for hours. At least I could talk to you about olives as much as you want, because I'm knee deep in literature review right now, too. So,
oh, man.
we don't have to keep going. I love what we talked about, and this has been a really fun experience for me. I was nervous before. I've kind of fangirled out, to put it that way, to be on the show I've been listening to for a year and a half now.
Well, I've enjoyed talking with you. So since you have listened for a while, you knew I was going to throw this at you.
Yeah.
And I do this to everyone. And it's funny because a lot of times people who listen to the show are still like, oh crap, I didn't think about it. Excuse me. So if you had a piece of advice or something that you want people to take home with them, to take away from this episode, what do you think that would be?
So you're right. Yeah, I've been formulating this answer since the first episode I've listened to. So I want to stretch the rules here. I kind of have two little things.
Sure.
that are really, I think, that have been really important to me and really impactful in my life, and that I try to apply everywhere in everything I do. And the first one is to be observant. I think that's kind of a lost skill. We go through lives, you know, we're kind of tuned into our phones and stuff. Take a moment. And I don't mean just like go and be in nature. I mean, it doesn't have to go. You don't have to go out into a forest or a natural area. Go sit on the sidewalk next to the strip of grass and just look down and focus. What do you see? What's the color of the grains of sand in the concrete? What ants are crawling across the sidewalk? What things are flying maybe just above the grass in the yard next to you? I mean, don't look for anything in particular. Just be observant. Be, you know, it's cliche to say be in the moment, but really kind of is. And that has led to me for some increased scientific understanding by accident. It's led to you know, clarity of mind and an improved focus. And so that's my first one, is to be observant in everything and everywhere as much as you can. The second one is the one I really love, and I should have looked up the quote before I got on here, but I'm going to wing it. It's a quote by Harrington Emerson, and he said, "As to methods, there may be a million or more, but principles are few. The man who selects methods ignoring principles is sure to have trouble. But the man who understands principles may successfully select his own methods." And, wow. You know, I think that applies to a lot of different parts of our lives. You know, mostly for me, it kind of applies to farming. So I got these new farmers that don't have much experience, and they just go online and they see that you're supposed to fertilize. You know, and so they just go out and buy a bag of fertilizer, the first one that's there, and they throw it out, not understanding the principles behind why, how much, what type, when do you apply it, how do you apply it, all those things. So that's what I mean by focus on understanding principles instead of just selecting methods. I think too much today we're on the internet, which is a wonderful, wonderful tool, but we don't use it to study those principles. We use it to like, oh, I think this looks cool. I'm going to cherry pick this method and apply it. And I think, you know, that can lead to some trouble. So I feel strongly, strongly about those two statements, understanding principles and being observant.
Wow. Yeah. That's all very powerful. I think that's, no, I mean, really, I was thinking as you were saying that, that's, the lack of those things has led to a lot of issues, and they're issues that we see very relevantly, I think, in our current society. So those are good things to remember. So, Man, I have really enjoyed this. I think that was awesome. Again, I could talk to you about olives and stuff all day, but where can we find you? What are your, plug your stuff?
This is one I hadn't prepared. because I don't know. I mean, I'm on Facebook and Twitter a little. I don't really post much. I don't, you know, you can follow me if you want, Steven Yannock. I don't even know what my Twitter handle is. I mostly use it to follow like current events and grad school stuff and plant stuff. So I'm out there if you want to connect. I don't know how to find me. Look up my name, STE.
Oh, I'll put links and stuff.
You can spell it. And then, you know, we have the Aggie Horticulture website. That's kind of where anything I find or publish will go. So,
okay.
That's kind of it.
All right. Well, very cool. Thanks again so much for coming on. And we may have to do this again one time as you get a little bit farther down the road. And I'd love to talk about, you know, your research and what you're getting into and all of that once you kind of get a little farther into it.
That'd be fantastic. I had a great time today. Thank you so much.
Awesome. Well, thanks everyone as always for listening. Y'all are the best, and we will see. I don't know what today is. I'll have told you at this point, but we'll see you either next week or in a couple of weeks or sometime in the future. But y'all keep being cool, and we will talk later. Awesome. You know what? It was awesome. It was so awesome. I really enjoyed talking to Steven again, and not just because he likes the show so much. That helps. For sure. But no, Steven's a great guy. He knows so much about plants. And when I think of cool plant people, Steven is pretty high up on that list. Thanks so much for listening. Y'all are the reason that this is worth doing. I really enjoy making this show, and it's because you people are so freaking awesome. So again, follow along on social media. We're all the places. Just look for Plantthropology. Connect with the show how you can. Reach out to guests if you want to know more about what they do. Maybe you'll find a passion for one of the things that they love. Next week, we actually have another episode. It's the next installment of our Plants in World Tradition series, where we'll be talking about different ways that different cultures have welcomed spring throughout time. I hope it feels like spring wherever you are. Again, I have no idea when you're listening to this, but I hope it feels like spring anyway. I love you folks. Keep being cool, plant people, and I'll talk to you next Tuesday.